Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 15, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Residents of Boya, Cameroon, lynched a police officer on Thursday for killing a five-year-old girl.
It's been a horrible day for every woman in Cameroon because this gives us memories of the 24th of October last year that we had the Kumba massacre. And 10 days to the 24th, we have the Boya murder.
There are calls for genuine dialogue in Eswatini as protests demanding democracy continue. African governments are called upon to strengthen their social protection systems, COVID-19 debt, and national budgets in Africa. And the people of Cape Verde are voting in presidential election this Sunday.
Actually, I'm tempted to say that there will be a runoff elections between those two candidates. However, I am inclined to say that in the second round, Carlos Vega is more likely to defeat José María Neves.
Somalia marks the anniversary of its deadliest terror attack. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An angry mob in the city of Boya, the capital of Cameroon's southwest region, yesterday, Thursday, killed a police officer after he shot into a moving car and killed a five-year-old girl who was being driven to school by her mother. The Cameroon government was not immediately available for comment, but the governor of the southwest region has reportedly described the incident as unfortunate and called for calm. Patibel Fika is a mother, a teacher, and founder of Hope for Vulnerables and Orphans. From the wake-keeping of the little girl, she tells me, the people of the southwest region have had enough of security forces' brutality. Fika says the mother of the deceased little girl did not violate any traffic rule. Instead, she said the police officer fired into the mother's vehicle because she refused to pay a bribe, the equivalent of less than $1.
It's indeed a pathetic situation because this is a baby who left home accompanied by her mom, her sister, and a guide to assist the mother in driving to go to school. And she gets to like 20 meters from her school and she is shot by a gendarme who stops the car asking for 500 francs. It's been a horrible day for every woman in Cameroon because this gives us memories of the 24th of October last year that we had the Kumba massacre. And then the 14th, just 10 days to the 24th, we have the Boya murder. It's a horrible day for us.
Did the mother do anything or did she violate any traffic rule? In other words, why would the police officer stop the mother?
She didn't violate any traffic rule. Now, it sees me thinking that the gendarme officers probably stopped her car because she has but the chassis number and not the regular number plate. That's my first guess. Now, the mother did not refuse to stand. She is learning how to drive. And so the moment she stopped, she drives a few meters away and parks the car. So she parks that car, gets out of the car, and then there is a man in the car who is a proper driver. So the man gets into the driver's seat and is struggling to reverse the car to where they were stopped. That is where the gendarme officer walks up to that car and then is asking for the money, because that is what usually happens. That is what happens, especially now with the crisis. The least thing, your car is stopped, they're asking you for car documents. When you have every car document, they ask you for 500 francs as bribe. Whatever that is for, we do not know. But that was what happened. So the gendarme officer went to that car and asked for 500 francs. And when they refused to give it, then he removed his gun and shot at that child.
We understand you are currently at a memorial for the little girl. What is the mood of the people there?
It is a very, very pathetic scene. It is so sad. It is something no one will wish to happen to any human being, not to talk of a baby who left with the aim of going to school and couldn't make it. So it's a horrible situation. The child was buried in the early hours of this evening, and the mother is inconsolable. No one can console her. She is in complete denial that her baby is dead, and that is a very bad thing. It's so heartbreaking.
Pochi Bell Faker is a mother, a teacher, and founder of Hope for Vulnerables and Orphans. She was speaking with us from Boya in Cameroon. In Eswatini, the political party assembly, the PPA, an umbrella group of parties, says genuine dialogue for democratic reforms is the solution to resolving the ongoing nationwide protests. Local media reports transport workers have also joined students who have been protesting for weeks to demand the freedom of detained two members of parliament as well as jobs for the youth. Bongiseni Shabangu is a leading member of the PPA and the general secretary of the Swaziland Democratic Party. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that dialogue mediated by the international community is the best way to resolve tensions in the Southern African kingdom.
I think, Peter, as a country and the leadership of the country, it missed an opportunity of establishing dialogue, which was going to do a peaceful transition into a constitutional monarch. Unfortunately, now the calls are starting to change. The rhetoric is changing, and people are starting to say they don't have a space for the monarch the way it treats its people. So I think that's the unfortunate thing that is starting to happen now. We lost an opportunity to talk to ourselves as a nation.
The Prime Minister in an interview said constitutional reforms forms part of the effort for democratic reforms. Is that the stance of political parties, some of which have been banned from participating in elections in Eswatini?
The statement of the Prime Minister is neither here nor there, because he knows very well that the dissenting voices are not in that space. Two, he knows that any parliamentary resolution can be decreed by the king. If he doesn't like it, it won't go. It's we're not talking about something he hasn't done before. Former Prime Minister Sibusiso Panaba Dlamini, there was a vote of no confidence on him. But the king didn't like the process. He vetoed the process, constitutional reform. That's why the political parties and civil society are calling for a peaceful, genuine dialogue that will be facilitated and overseen by international bodies and international community.
So if I may ask you, why do you think young people in Eswatini or the youth are basically saying the king should go?
The young people, Peter, most of them have... Okay, I will make an example of this group that has had to go through university. After having gone through this difficult process, graduate, for some of them up to 8 years now, they are not employed. So the anger among the young people, they don't see a future with the monarch. When the monarch lashes so much money on their lavish lifestyle, When a royal child can spend 21 million on a watch, when that money can pay for thousands of high school kids, I think that's the reason young people are thinking we cannot have a space for a monarch in this shape and form. And whenever we try to convince them that maybe let's try a constitutional monarch, most of them they've just given up on the monarch and the royal family, that it can ever take care of their needs as young people. We need dialogue. As of yesterday, Peter, we need to sit down and map a way forward that is internationally facilitated. Because remember, the king and the monarch and his government don't then recognize political parties. The reason they are not calling political parties into a roundtable, they don't even recognize their existence.
Bongiseni Shabangu is a leading member of the political party assembly and the general secretary of the Swaziland Democratic Party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. The people of Cape Verde will vote this Sunday in presidential election. The vote follows parliamentary elections in April this year. The two leading candidates are former Prime Minister José María Neves of the African Party for the Independence of Cape Verde, the PAICV, and Carlos Vega of the ruling Movement for Democracy, the MPD Party. Incumbent President Jorge Carlos Fonseca, who is concluding his second term, is not running due to term limit. Abel Jassy Amado is assistant professor of political science at Simmons University in Boston. He says the two candidates have run a competitive campaign and there is a possibility of a runoff election.
First and foremost, it needs to be said that presidential elections in a country like Cape Verde are not the main elections. They're still important, but the president does not hold as much power because whoever gets to take that position is not the head of government. Nonetheless, it's still a highly competitive elections, and the two main parties, namely the PAICV and the current incumbent party, MPD, are in this electoral game. In fact, the two main candidates, Carlos Vega and José María Neves, are supported by the two parties.
Professor, incumbent President Jorge Carlos Fonseca, is he seeking re-election? Because I know he's serving, what, two terms now?
No, he can't. According to the Constitution, the president cannot go more than two terms. But I want to mention that, you know, even though the two main candidates that I pointed out, José María Neves and Carlos Vega, are quite ahead of the game, the electoral game, the presidential electoral game, is highly competitive. There is a total of seven candidates. The other five, they are minor candidates, but it just shows how electoral game is now accepted in Cape Verde as part of a political life.
The two parties, the PAICV and the Movement for Democracy, MPD, their candidates, you said that they are competing fiercely, but who do you think might come out victorious on Sunday?
Right now, it's quite difficult. I actually am tempted to say that there will be a runoff election, so a second round between those two candidates. However, I am inclined to say that in the second round, Carlos Vega is more likely to defeat José María Neves, not only because he has far more financial resources behind his electoral campaigns, but it seems that he is most likely to bring support from other candidates and from other small parties.
Professor, before I let you go, it seems that particularly recently, elections in Africa, West Africa in particular also, have been contentious. Am I right to say that that is not the case for Cape Verde?
Well, in a way, you are right to say. I think there is a number of reasons that explain the level of acceptance of electoral outcome. First of all, one can make the argument that there is now a tradition of elections. You know, the democratic transition happened 30 years ago, and we are now going into eight round of presidential elections. So in a way, candidates, the political elite, and the general population have adopted and have adapted to this new culture of electoral democracy. And second, we can also include the role of the Cabo Verdean diaspora in softening any type of conflict. I must add that for presidential elections and for parliamentary elections, the Cabo Verdeans who live abroad, they are entitled to vote. And in presidential elections, more particularly, the vote of the diaspora tend to weigh a lot.
Professor Amando, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you.
It's always a pleasure.
That was Abel Jassy Amando, assistant professor of political science at Simmons University in Boston, Massachusetts. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 15. The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch says African governments will have to strengthen their social protection systems and fulfill people's rights to social security and adequate standards of living. The group says while many African countries introduced measures such as cash transfers and food assistance in response to the rising poverty and hunger caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, most households received no support. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA.
In Kenya and Nigeria, Human Rights Watch documented job losses, falling income, and widespread hunger among people living in poverty in the cities of Nairobi and Lagos. Speaking in a virtual media conference on why the COVID-19 pandemic shows the need to fix Africa's social safety net, the Human Rights Watch East Africa director Otieno Namwaya said that families in informal settlement were highly affected and displaced.
Families in the informal settlements had been hugely affected by the COVID-19. Some were going hungry for as many as 4 to 5 days in a week. Others could not access water. Others could be were facing the threat of eviction. Even though the actual eviction that happened was actually by the government itself, which started construction projects in the middle of the government, in response to these effects, set up a cash transfer program. But what happened is that when the government finally implemented the program, money didn't actually reach them.
Between March 2020 and August 2021, Human Rights Watch interviewed more than 270 people in Cameroon, Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, and Uganda about the impact of the pandemic on access to food and livelihoods and government efforts to respond. Aniti Ewang, Nigerian researcher at Human Rights Watch, said that the government of Nigeria failed to support citizens who lost their income during the pandemic.
Our research found that most people who had lost jobs or income or had gone hungry during the pandemic received no support from their government. In Nigeria, for example, our analysis of government survey data found that while more than half of households had gone hungry in May through to November of last year.
Dr. Solomon Daso, chairperson, African Commission on Human and People's Rights, said that most African governments neglected their citizens as some had no resources to manage the situation.
When it comes to Africa, it's most dramatic, and indeed some of the basic from the scourge of COVID-19 were sanitation, water. And we have come to realize that actually these are areas in respect of which there was increasing neglect on the part of policymakers and in terms of resource allocation.
On the other hand, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Olivia Duchata, said that there was an increase in child labor in many African countries due to school closure.
The very worrying increase of child labor as a result of the pandemic. Today, we have some 160 million children working in the world, and this figure has risen quite significantly as a result of the crisis. It's very troubling because it shows that this crisis will have impacts beyond just generation.
In Kenya, the research also highlighted an increase in violence against women and girls during the COVID-19 related lockdowns and curfews, while in Ghana and Uganda, there was an increase in child labor. According to the International Labour Organization, over 80% of Africans had no access to social protection in 2020. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
14 out of 16 countries are planning to cut their national budgets by billions of dollars over the next 5 years due to debt incurred from COVID-19. The move would vastly increase poverty and inequality, says international non-governmental organization OFAM. The group's West Africa Regional Director, Barcelona Dawala Sidi, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the International Monetary Fund's role in the planned cuts and what better alternatives Oxfam believes are possible that will not cut into education, healthcare, and more.
If this happens, it's going to be a huge disaster. It's going to be the most difficult and the most disaster austerity for this part of the world. And this austerity will trigger the worst inequality crisis in decades, because this is going to happen in a time where only 4% of West Africans have been yet vaccinated against COVID-19. This would happen in a time where the Sahel is already experiencing one of its worst hunger crisis. This is going to happen, you know, when 7 million jobs have been already lost in 2020 as a result of the pandemic. And this would hit mostly women because they are the ones working in the informal sector, women who are not already paid. This means less investment in the service social, in the social service, you know, care such as health, education, and social protection.
As the release mentions, these budget cuts are encouraged by the IMF. Can you talk a little bit about the international dynamics between national governments and the IMF when it comes to these loans, when it comes to who gets a say in how these national budgets are spent and decided?
Indeed, IMF has a big role in this because most of the West African countries, to adequately face, I mean, manage the pandemic, they had to take loans from the IMF. Now they are trying all to pay this loan back, and this is being done, you know, in detriment to the country's revenue. The rich countries, which the IMF depends, should definitely act to stop this plan of austerity. And this could be done by reviewing the conditions and the requirements, such as these countries can't afford the debt that they have contracted. The debt, for instance, if we take a country like Senegal, Mali, and Burkina, these countries, in terms of debt payment, debt reimbursement, they're investing around 61% in debt payment, higher than what they invest in the health. So this should really stop.
That was Barcelona Dawala Sidi, West Africa Regional Director for Oxfam. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Niamey, Niger. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Kenya, where police in the East African country say they have arrested the husband of record-breaking runner Agnes Tirop after she was found stabbed to death in her home this week. Judge Kinoti, the director of criminal investigations in Kenya, said that the suspect was arrested in the coastal city of Mombasa and that he is in custody and he was arrested while fleeing. Kenyan distance runner Agnes Tirop, a 2-time world championship bronze medalist, was found stabbed to death at her home. President of Athletics Kenya, Jackson Twee, wants a speedy judicial process following the death of the record-breaking runner.
This is a life cut short, one that will pain us as a federation for quite a long time. We are confident the relevant agencies are working round the clock to ensure speedy justice to the family and friends who have been left emotionally scarred by the demise of someone they depended on for financial and psychological support.
In basketball news, Masai Ujiri, the proprietor, giant of Africa Basketball Foundation, has unveiled the 4th basketball court in Lagos, built by his foundation in his quest to build no fewer than 100 basketball courts across Africa. Masai Ujiri is the first and only African-born president and general manager of a professional sports franchise in North America, the National Basketball Association's Toronto Raptors. An elated Ujiri said the essence of providing basketball courts was to nurture talents and develop future champions for Nigeria and the rest of Africa.
We made a commitment to build 100 courts around the continent over the years. We started in East Africa, and we've built 4 in Nigeria, and we're happy to be here with the kids celebrating.
In football news, South Africa Football Association is reportedly considering plans to increase fan attendance to 20,000 for Bafana Bafana's next match. Bafana Bafana are set to take on neighbors Zimbabwe at home in their next 2022 Soccer World Cup qualifier, and SAFA are looking to crank up the atmosphere for that fixture. Bafana Bafana's 1-0 victory over Ethiopia in the second of the back-to-back 2022 World Cup qualifiers marked a monumental moment in South African football. It marked the first occasion of a return to fans in South Africa sports, with SAFA allowing 2,000 fully vaccinated and fortunate fans through the FNB Stadium in Soweto. Staying with football news, CAF has made public the pairings for the third round of the qualifiers for the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup Costa Rica 2022. The games will be played in December 2021 all over the continent. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, October 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.